Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And now, while we're waiting for the apocalypse, the rule of nobody. Philip K. Howard, most known for his best-selling book, The Death of Common Sense, argues in his new book that Democrats are right to want strong government oversight of the marketplace, and Republicans are right that much of government is overbearing and wasteful. Where they are both wrong, he argues, is where they agree with each other, that regulations be as detailed as possible to minimize human judgment. Hence the title of Philip Howard's new book, The Rule of Nobody. Think Toby, Josh, and Donna from The West Wing.
An employee may not use contract airline rail passenger service provided under the contract with the General Services Administration, see Part 301-15, Subpart B of this chapter.
What's the problem?
Well, let's set aside that there's no Subpart B. The rest of it uses a sentence structure with which I'm not familiar.
Just put it on my credit card.
No, see, I think that's what this is designed to do. I think it's designed to break a person's spirit.
And damn it, that's my job.
We're getting beat by the system.
We are the system.
We suck.
Yes.
How many words in the Gettysburg Address?
266.
And the Ten Commandments?
173.
So you really wouldn't think you'd need 6,000 to discover how a plane ticket gets reimbursed?
No.
No.
37 seconds from The West Wing to set up Philip K. Howard, author of The Rule of Nobody. Philip, welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back.
I've never seen you laugh like that. Did you know that scene from West Wing?
I don't. I'm going to go get it.
So it relates to the example from your book, the Volcker Rule, the much-debated new rule, that prohibits Wall Street firms from placing bets on certain high-risk speculative investments that don't benefit their customers, like the ones that contributed to the financial crisis. Some people love the Volcker Rule. Wall Street hates it. But either way, it sounds simple enough. No high-risk investments that present conflicts of interest with your customers. But how many pages is the Volcker Rule?
963 pages. And it requires the banks to answer 438 questions each month so that people can determine whether or not they're violating the precepts of this really very simple goal, which is basically to ban proprietary trading for its own sake.
And do you think a 1,000-page Volcker Rule somehow diminishes the effectiveness of the Volcker Rule?
It completely makes it counterproductive. It will be nothing but loopholes. The more words there are, the sooner the Wall Street whiz kids will figure out what words are not there, and they'll figure out how to make trades in those interstices. In the meantime, you've got literally scores of lawyers and inspectors having migraine headaches trying to interpret the 963 pages.
Another example from your book, the Affordable Care Act. And to be clear, you're not coming out against Obamacare as policy, but against the fact of how detailed and specific its rules get?
Absolutely. The rules are now over 7 feet high. You can't even measure them in words or number of rules. And all this detail makes it impossible to actually accomplish the goals, because life is too complicated to write in advance in words, any more than anybody listening to this could plan their life by saying in the morning, I'm going to do this at 10:26. I guess maybe you can. But most people can't actually do that.
I have to.
Yeah. And so what you have is Obama, President Obama, now actually not complying with the terms of his own law because he can't comply and actually get the job done.
So you point out, for example, that it's 2,700 pages. I guess that equals 7 feet, and includes things like a 28-word definition of high school, and that it sets up a rule for counting resident time for didactic and scholarly activity, whatever that means. But could Obamacare be much less written out and still clearly set up the system it's aiming at?
Sure. But most complicated social programs require goals and principles and accountability measures, but you must give the people on the ground the freedom to try to create institutions and then adapt them the same way a business would if it were trying to perform the same service. No business writes a 2,700-page statute and on top of that the 7 feet of regulations in advance. They set goals. They have all sorts of ideas about how it might work, but they're not law. They don't put shackles on people. And so the problem with this idea of running government is it shackles people from ever actually adapting to real life.
Hence the title of your book, The Rule of Nobody?
Yes. So literally at this point, democracy is basically run by dead people. It's an accretion of law. It's paralyzed, not because of polarized politics. I think that's a symptom of the paralysis. Because every year you get more laws, more regulations. They're all equally rigid. They all have unintended consequences, and they pile up like sediment in the harbor till we're at the point where literally people can't do anything. A few weeks ago, President Obama issued a 5-year report on the 2009 stimulus plan, $800 billion. Remember, the main goal was to rebuild America's infrastructure, which is decrepit. It's got a D-plus rating. It's shameful what's happened to our infrastructure, 100-year-old sewage pipes, et cetera. I wanted to know how much was actually spent on this $800 billion on infrastructure, buried in the back of the report. Barely 3% of the money was spent on transportation infrastructure. Why is that? Because, as the president discovered after he got the program, there's no such thing as a shovel-ready project. No one, not even the president, has the authority to approve the most obvious rebuilding projects. We're not talking about wires through virgin forest. We're talking about rebuilding existing bridges and roads and things. Even the president lacks the authority. So literally,
because of environmental laws, you're saying, right?
Well, not just environmental laws, but permits. I tell the story of rebuilding the Bayonne Bridge, 47 permits from 19 different agencies. It took them 4 years to get approval for a project that had zero environmental impact. They were just raising the roadway, existing foundations, and then now followed by a lawsuit. So you have this structural paralysis of our system of government.
Listeners want to talk back to or ask a question of Philip K. Howard, author now of The Rule of Nobody. I guess the progressive dilemma here, and maybe some of you work in city government, have worked in city or county, whatever government, even federal government, and want to back up or refute his contention that if you believe in activist government, if you're trying to get something done for the people, that the amount of government itself, ironically, paradoxically, hampers you, the amount of bureaucracy within the system that you're trying to use for good, the rule of nobody. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you want to speak to Philip K. Howard this morning, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And you mentioned lawsuits, and I know you hate our litigious society and how that drags things
right
down. But can your notion of less specific law and less specific regulation really work without leading to more lawsuits? Because I'm thinking once you have a general legal principle, and only a general legal
right
principle, interested parties will push up against the limits of that, like banks that want to define for themselves which risky investments present conflicts of interest with their customers under the Volcker Rule, and then a million lawsuits might inevitably result to resolve all the gray areas.
Right. That's a great question. So two responses. First, the current system doesn't minimize it, maximizes it. Everybody's just playing word games. They're parsing words. So you can always find the basis for a dispute within all the words. The Constitution's 10 pages long, you know, the Volcker Rule, 963 pages. You'll get litigation on both, but at least the litigation on the Constitution focuses on the goals. What do we mean by free speech or unreasonable searches and seizures? So I'll give an example. Australia, a couple of decades ago, had 1,000 rules for their nursing homes. They didn't work any better than they do in this country. Somebody had the bright idea of scrapping all the rules, all these rules that say, you know, 80 square feet per resident, you know, et cetera. They replaced them with 31 general principles. Have a home-like setting. Respect the dignity of the residents. Things like that. The experts scoffed. These nursing homes are going to get away with murder. Within a year, the nursing homes were twice as good. And they've gotten better, and the studies have shown this, over the succeeding decades. And the reason is because people go to work asking themselves the question, what's the right thing to do here? I can make an exception for this resident. They want to do this. Let's do that. When there's an issue, people get together, talk about it. Regulators didn't give up their authority. They can still close down an abusive nursing home or whatever. But instead of coming in and giving tickets for immaterial noncompliance, that wastebasket is not in the bathroom. It's a foot outside the bathroom or whatever. They actually talk about how to improve. So there's a phrase for it. It's called new governance, where regulators actually, instead of being these cops, come in and say, we want to help you improve. And they work with them to make it better. And it worked in this case to have principles-based regulation.
But we've had a problem in New York State of under-regulation of nursing homes.
Yes, but New York State has 1,000 rules. And so you have all these rules, and they don't work. And so one of the parts of the book is that when you have detailed rules, they end up being counterproductive because everyone goes through the day with their noses in the rule books instead of trying to make the homes better. And it's all about compliance. And a lot of that compliance is paperwork compliance. So I tell a story from New York State where one of the officials in the regulatory agency got in trouble because she went behind the paperwork and said, hey, wait a minute, this paperwork is false. It purports to comply, but in fact, they didn't do those things. And she said she was told her job was simply to make sure the paperwork was in order.
Ephraim in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Ephraim.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Thanks for bringing this up. I would like to offer an interesting conspiracy theory by the government. Just follow my logic. The lower the speed of the car, the longer the car is on the road. This is obvious, right? So the lower the speed all the cars are driving, the more time they are on the road. Therefore, we need more roads. The slower the speed limits, the lower the speed limits.
Are you talking about the current push by the de Blasio administration to lower the New York City speed limit?
Not only New York, it's a universal law. The lower the speed limit, the more money we need to allocate for road constructions. So the government is obviously interested in putting more money for the constituency.
I understand. Do you have roots in the old Soviet Union by any chance?
You got it.
Okay. I think self-explanatory. Ephraim, thank you very much. Wendy in Greenwich Village, who identifies herself to our screener, as a what? A benefits attorney? Wendy, do we have Wendy ready to go? Wendy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I'm an employee benefits attorney in Greenwich Village, and I think that Mr. Howard is somewhat unfairly castigating the procedure under which regulations are issued, particularly with regard to the Affordable Care Act, because every time a new batch of them come out, and they come out at like 155 pages every time they come out, they're preceded by what they call a preamble, which is a plain English discussion of the intent of the rules. And they provide examples, and they say, here are some of the criteria that you should use when interpreting this funny term that the regs use, and these are not the only criteria, and use your common sense, and they're extremely helpful, and I think they, in fact, do exactly what Mr. Howard is advocating.
Yeah, I think there are parts of the Affordable Care Act. Again, I'm not an attacker of the Affordable Care Act. I just think there are other parts of it that are just way too detailed and migraine-inducing, and that's the stories I hear from the field from providers are pretty terrible. People can't figure it out.
Anne in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Oh, good morning, Brian. I am a professional writer for major Fortune 500 companies, and I'm also an award-winning nonfiction humor writer. And I unfortunately had to spend over a decade in housing court, and I discovered quite quickly that it's a secret language that these lawyers use, and they use a stupid piece of paper called legal paper. I think they're in cahoots with Xerox. But I'm telling you, this language, it was astonishing. I was sending copies of it to some of my writing teachers from college. It was just amazing.
Legalese. Anne in the East Village finding it too easy to write humor about the legalese. So you want, Philip K. Howard, our United States Constitution to add something to our Bill of Rights, a Bill of Responsibilities, 5 new amendments to the Constitution. So what would be the First Amendment of a Bill of Responsibilities?
The First Amendment would be a sunset provision for all laws with budgetary impact. Our founders, there are some institutional design issues here. Our founders actually made a mistake. They didn't realize it would be exponentially harder to change a law than it is to pass it in the first place, because as soon as it's passed, it gets an army of special interests around it. That's why no one in Congress ever goes back and says, how's the law working? Not to get rid of it. Again, I'm not a deregulator, but to make sure it works. I mean, no one intended special ed to use up 25% of the total K-12 budget in this country. It just kind of evolved that way. And now there's no money left over for other good programs. So you need something that requires Congress to go back and do this job. So the First Amendment would say all laws must sunset and they can't be reenacted until an independent commission has given a report on the effectiveness of the law and there's been a chance for public debate so that the public can get involved in this about whether we really want to spend the money that way.
Reassess every 15 years. How about your Second Amendment? Nothing to do with guns, I presume.
Nothing to do with guns. The Second Amendment would be to re-empower the executive branch to actually run the executive branch. Congress is so intruded into the presidency, and President Obama's been talking about this, that you can't hire and fire people who don't do the job because of the way civil service systems have evolved. You can't avoid spending money even after programs are canceled if they've been, if they're in the budget. And so you have an executive branch where, under the Constitution, executive power supposedly lies in the president. But in fact, the president can't even appoint outside advisors the way he wants to. There's something called the Federal Advisory Committee Act that dictates everything. So literally the president's shackled in all these ways that prevent him from being an executive.
Again, the rule of nobody, not even the president of the United States.
Yeah.
One more. Your Fourth Amendment in your Bill of Responsibilities, to go with the Bill of Rights, would require judges to rule on the reasonableness of lawsuits. They don't do that now?
No, they don't. We have this idea, it came out of this notion of avoiding judicial activism, that judges are just neutral referees, and anybody can sue almost for anything in this society. They can block, as they are, the Bayonne Bridge, trying to block the reconstruction of the Bayonne Bridge for no good reason.
Justice Roberts said the job of a justice is to be an umpire.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the problem is, suing is not an act of freedom. It's an act of state power. Somebody brings a lawsuit and somebody says, okay, you win. The state will come in and take your home away or whatever. And so judges, if we want lawsuits to support freedom, judges actually have to assert what they believe to be the legal and reasonable social norms of who can sue for what.
That's
and they need to do that right up front.
It's interesting because libertarians, correct me if I'm wrong, while they hate state power, believe in the tort system because they think that's individual versus individual.
It's completely backwards. So, for example, you have this crazy society today where teachers are told never to put an arm around a crying child and playgrounds don't have any jungle gyms or seesaws, not because anybody said those were too dangerous or bad things to do, because everyone's scared of being sued. So these waves of defensiveness. My own employer says I can't give job references because you might get sued if you give a job reference. And so you have the land of the First Amendment where people are prohibited from being honest about other people. It's madness.
We have under a minute. When you were on The Daily Show, Jon Stewart introduced you by saying, Philip K. Howard has always struck him as an eminently reasonable advocate for common sense solutions. No wonder nobody listens to him. Is anyone in Washington listening to you?
Not to my knowledge, although a few senators are. But the bottom line is our system of government is broken. Everybody knows it. Change is not going to happen from Washington. This isn't mainly a leadership problem. It's an institutional design problem. We're going to have a spring cleaning, not to get rid of regulation, but to make it work.
Philip K. Howard, author of The Rule of Nobody. Thank you.
Thank you.